Gary Petty in there mentioned, as we saw beyond today, was mentioning and talking at length about what happened there. Well, I say Mr. Gary Petty, he's the one who commented, because he made a comment about what happens in the remainder of the book of Acts. But initially, Mr. Darris McNeely's message on Acts served as a nice transition, segue into what I'm going to cover today. We've been making our way through the book of Acts, and we're going to head for Acts 27 today, which you see on the screen. That's Caesarea, artist depiction. We're going to make our way through Acts 27. But if you remember back to Acts 26, let's do some review. In Acts 26, we actually read the last of Paul's five defenses. In the last defense, we had opportunity to read of and cover Paul's defense to King Agrippa. Now, Agrippa was a unique audience from this vantage point. Agrippa was well familiar with the Jewish faith. He was well familiar with what Paul's legacy was. He was well familiar that Paul had been taught at the feet of Gamaliel. And so Paul used this as a unique opportunity to preach the gospel in a way that he hadn't during those previous defenses. Paul's familiarity then with Agrippa allows him to go back and offer further details about his calling. He gives us information in Acts 26 that we otherwise didn't get previously in the book of Acts. Once Paul finishes, if you remember in Acts 26 as a reminder here, the first thing that Festus does is call him on the carpet about this. And he does so by saying the following, "Paul, you're mad. There's no way it works this way." Now, you have to understand why Festus would do this. In part, he would do this because, again, he's the one making a decision. But as well, what Paul has talked about here in terms of spiritual principles, they were foreign to Festus. He couldn't make sense of these. Not only was he not a religious person from the vantage or from the perspective that Paul was speaking, but he just had a hard time wrapping his mind around what Paul was getting to here. Yet Festus' accusation kind of precedes the ultimate judgment that he winds up giving, that Agrippa gives. Agrippa, in hearing this, then makes the following decision. He says, you know, in short, Paul has done nothing wrong. He's on trial for something that's supposed to be a violation of Roman law, and this has nothing to do with Roman law. This is a religious dispute. And in that, Paul was a Roman citizen, if you recall, and he had already appealed to Caesar. They had to ship him to Rome so that he could go to Caesar and he could spread the gospel there. Remember previously, he had been told, you will make it all the way to Rome and be able to preach the gospel there. And so in this case, Festus, despite the fact he could acquit Paul, chooses not to. He's actually forced by Paul's words to send Paul to Rome. So that said, we're going to deal with Acts 27 today, and I've entitled this message because we're not going to get all the way to Rome today. I'd love to tell you we get to Rome. We don't. We get as far as Malta today. I've entitled this message, Paul's Trip to Rome Begins. Paul's Trip to Rome Begins. So let's play with some maps for a second, because I think it's helpful for us to get a sense for where we are. So we saw earlier, even on Beyond Today, the maps that we were dealing with, and I'm going to run the highlighter here, the laser pointer. We're dealing with this section here. In fact, as we go through this message, we're going to travel a long way. Whereas previously we were in one spot dealing with one defense, today we're going to move from somewhere around here, and we're going to move north, and then we're going to wrap our way around Cyprus, and we're going to swing up, and then we're going to come down, and we're going to try and park ourselves underneath here, and then we're going to swing all the way over to Malta. So in one chapter, about 40-some verses, 40-plus verses, we're going to go through a lot. You're seeing something. Am I what? Oh, good. Thank you. When in doubt, listen. Okay, cool. Okay, let's go here. If we're dealing with a different map. Now, here's an older map. Down here it says Paul's Voyage to Rome. And here's the green path that we're gonna travel here. Here's Cyprus and Myra. We're going to go over here to Salmone and then around to Fair Havens. We're going to talk about Phoenix. And boy, it's going to get really ugly right in here. In fact, this little box is where we spend a bulk of our story, because we're going to barely hold things together. If you ever have had that Johnny Depp kind of Pirates of the Caribbean feeling, we're going to have that during this message, because it's all going to happen right in here, and then we'll eventually make it to Malta. But that said, that's our path. Now, oftentimes in these messages, I throw out facts. Not doing that today. I'm asking you five questions, five quiz questions, and I'm asking that you answer these of the contents of Acts 27. So are you ready? Here we go. Question one. Question one. Who is the author of Acts 27? Who is the author of Acts 27? Now that's kind of a gimme. But who is the author of Acts 27? It's the same author of all of those. You want the answer already? Let me offer all five, and then we'll go back and answer them. Question two: who are Paul's travel companions from Caesarea to Malta that are listed in Acts 27? There are two. Now, one of them we just kind of noted for that first question, and then a second one, a separate travel companion, is noted there in Acts 27. So he had two travel companions that went with him. And that's separate from the centurion, the soldier that was responsible for him. Question three. What feast and holy day is mentioned in Acts 27? What feast and holy day is mentioned in Acts 27? Question four. We're up to four. An angel tells Paul something in Acts 27. What does he tell him? An angel tells Paul something in Acts 27. What does he tell him? And then five, our last question. There is a shipwreck that occurs at the end of Acts 27. How many people die in this shipwreck? There's a shipwreck that occurs at the end of Acts 27. How many people die in that shipwreck? Okay, so let's do some grading. First question, who is the author of Acts 27? Anyone have this one? It's still Luke. We haven't changed. Luke is our guy. Okay, so he stays our author here. He's still writing. Question two, who were Paul's travel companions from Caesarea to Malta and then on to Rome? We know Luke is one of them, so I gave you one. And anyone else? Aristarchus, we're going to see. Fancy name. I thought long and hard about naming Jordan Aristarchus, but I thought that would be unfair. Aristarchus is the other travel companion we'll read about here shortly. Question three, what feast and holy day is noted in Acts 27? I'll give you the hint. He references it as the fast, which would mean the Day of Atonement. We're going to see that mentioned here. It's key to the narrative, to the story that he offers. Four, there's an angel that tells Paul something in Acts 27. What does he tell him? Ooh, this one almost needs a drum roll. He says, no one will die on this ship. Now that's a tall order, because as you'll see here, we're dealing with almost 300 people on a ship. And it's going to get really ugly before it gets good. So for this angel to appear and tell him that no one will die was big news. Last question I asked was, how many die in the shipwreck then? And I've already answered this question. No one dies. No one dies. Maybe that was unfair. I got a whole lot of eyebrows going up. But that said, no one dies. So that's where we're going. So if we're going to break down this one single chapter into some sections, I'm going to ask you to break it down this way, and I'll cover it in these four sections. First of all, I've just entitled section 1, verses 1 through 8, Paul's trip to Rome begins. Paul's trip to Rome begins. Section 2, Paul warns of disaster. That's verses 9 through 12. We'll only deal with a few verses there. Section 3, the stormy seas. The stormy seas. That's 13 through 38, and that's the biggest section we'll cover today. And then section 4, shipwrecked at Malta. Shipwrecked at Malta. Okay, so with that said, let's take a look at Caesarea. Let's see what we have going here. I've got to go this way. Okay, so we're down here, way at the bottom. Okay, and I'm going to keep going. Come on. There we go. Caesarea Today. That's what it looks like. You know, for a second here, I thought to myself, maybe I'm the Beamed travel agent today. Because that's really the sense I'm getting, and they're planning to go to Turkey, and they may see some of these places. But this is Caesarea Today. So remember the artist's rendition? It had all this building that was up here. Okay, this is what it looks like today. They've uncovered the Colosseum here, the amphitheater. Obviously, it was a major harbor in terms of a port of trade, so we see all of that here. And then this is what it would look like if you were walking the streets. Okay, you would see some of these arches, and this is only part of it. There's the realistic part of what we're dealing with. So that said, that's where we're starting. And again, if I should have offered the following, my notes come from not only my Ambassador College courses that I took that address all of this, but also the Ambassador Bible College notes that are provided online and numerous commentaries, which I'll reference as we go. So that said, we're in verse 1. And when it was decided that we should sail to Italy, they delivered Paul and some other prisoners to one named Julius, not Orange Julius, Julius, a centurion of the Augustan regiment. So by background here, Julius was part of the Imperial Guard. He was really part of a special commission that had unique duties. And in a case like this, the Romans had special groups of people in order to do certain tasks, and Julius was one of them. Verse 2, so entering a ship at Adramidium, we put to sea, meaning to sail along the coasts of Asia. Aristarchus, a Macedonian of Thessalonica, was with us. So commentaries offer a number of things about Aristarchus. We know Aristarchus came up previously because his name shows up in Acts 19 and 20. We also know that likely in that Paul had health difficulties. 2 Corinthians 12, verse 7, he needed a physician with him. There was that theoretically that he needed. And Luke was a physician, so that's not a stretch. Now, we're not necessarily sure if Aristarchus was an assistant directly to Paul or an assistant of Luke. But one way or another, he was along as in assistance form to provide some assistance to Paul as he made his journey. So with that said, we see both of those individuals as part of Paul's traveling companion. That happened to be question two that I offered. The next day we landed, I'm back in verse 3, at Sidon, and Julius treated Paul kindly and gave him liberty to go to his friends and receive care. Now again, and we were even talking about this between congregations when we were walking, we still don't know what Paul had as an affliction, do we? We know that he speaks of having difficulty of sight at one point, but the idea that he needed care gives us some other indication that his health wasn't the best, that he must have needed treatment or rest or something to that effect. Now, if you're on the map with me, we've gone here from Caesarea to Sidon. So we're up just a hair, and I want you to see some of Sidon. This is Sidon today. Okay, there are a whole lot of houses, a whole lot of buildings. I guess not townhomes. That's how the city is laid out. We can see these streets as they go through here. You can see different streets walking through. And obviously, because it's coastal, you see a lot of water. This happens to be called the castle at Sidon. So archaeologically, this one is, they have gone back and dug up what we see here. Now, obviously, they do not have the entire castle. It had to have been a key location principally for protection of the land and in order to govern those waterways. And so we see some of that played out here. And so that's the reference that we see to Sidon in verse 3. Verse 4, when we had put to sea from there, we sailed under the shelter of Cyprus because the winds were contrary. So I'm going to go to the next slide. Now I'm going to ask you to note a couple of things here. We're at Sidon, and he's making reference to sailing this route right here. Okay, now here's the surprise, because if you go back and look at generally how merchant ships would have traveled from anywhere along this coast over to Malta and ultimately to Rome, they didn't go this direction. They actually, believe it or not, went down here to Alexandria, and then they went all the way across. So what, for whatever reason, as we see our travels here and watch and understand where Paul is going, that first jaunt here, where at some point here they're going to catch a new ship, They chose to go north. Now, and when I went and read numerous commentaries on this, see these little lines that are here? They give indication of generally how the weather and the winds and the waves all tended to be directed, particularly around that time of year. Now remember, we've already noted this, that the Feast of Atonement, the fast, is a fall time of the year. So seasonally, it would not be such a surprise why they chose to go this direction. But again, they're taking a different route for Paul in order to get there. And so that's what we see reflected in 4. 5, and when he had sailed over the sea, which is off of Cilicia and Pamphylia, we came to Myra, a city of Lycia. And that's up here. See, we have Lycia. Here's Myra. And we're going to see a change of boats. So they're going to go from whatever boat here. We're not sure what size boat this was. But the big boat that they wind up getting on here is going to be a merchant ship. And a big ship with a whole lot of people, as we'll see later on here. If I backtrack just shortly, Sidon happened to be 70 miles north of Caesarea. And we had, without missing something here, it is helpful to note that the centurion favored Paul. Now again, Paul was a prisoner, but he favors Paul and he gives Paul some latitude in terms of behavior, even as a prisoner. And we'll see that even more so as we go, where he'll take the time, Paul as a prisoner, to listen to Paul. Or to allow Paul, not necessarily under house arrest, some latitude to go back and forth and to do some things, as we've already given indication here. So what we see here is that this centurion has respect for Paul, despite the fact Paul is his prisoner. And it'll come out even more so as the story unfolds. Verse 6, the centurion found an Alexandrian ship sailing to Italy, and he put on board. And when we had sailed slowly, many days, and arrived with difficulty off Cnidus, the wind not permitting us to proceed, we sailed under the shelter of Crete off of Salmone. And so that's where we get into here, Salmone. So they made some decision here to switch ships. And then they said, again with direction of wind, they said, we're not going to go up and across. We're going to go down, and then we're going to slide down underneath. And so that's what they've spoken of here. So let's go some pictures. Oh, when in doubt, throw an arrow up. There's Myra. So let me show you Myra for a second. Here's archaeological finds today with Myra. Obviously, you see the coastal region, lots of water here. We get the walls of whatever this home is. It appears to be here. We get some sense of what it all looks like. We also get a sense of the landscape out here, mountainous. And then we get here, you can see the water. The harbor must be back behind here. This is certainly one of the amphitheaters. You know, you even look back engineering-wise at what they were able to do. Pretty remarkable stuff in terms of advancement. And as you can see here, we see a number of things. We see some of the structures here to the left. We see a walkway, but this gives you, again, a sense of Myra. Let's keep going. There's Salmone, which is what I made reference of. And this is what it looks like. You can see, by perspective, I pulled this picture. Here's a little boat here. So again, coastal region, kind of dry and arid climate, but they've got greenery off here. That looks pretty. Maybe this is me. That has vacation all over it, right there. And these tend to be harbors. Now, let me go one more. What we're seeing here, and you'll see as you look around Cyprus, and in order to be fair here, I've not been to Cyprus, but two people will be possibly soon. You've got a whole lot of harbors all the way around here. And so what we'll see here is they're going to talk through these harbors, because those who happen to be associated with sailing were well acquainted, well familiar with different places they could stop, and as we'll see here, winter. Spend the winter in a protected position. So with that said, we've made our way up to 8. Passing it with difficulty, we came to a place called Fair Havens near the city of Lycia. So we're down here, we've stopped here, and then we've dropped down. To provide, again, some sense of date, we have between verses 4 and 5, that was 15 days. As I've already noted here in verse 6, that happened to be a merchant ship. That was a wheat carrying vessel. And what we've seen spoken of here thus far is indeed they're trying to make sense of how to use the weather patterns to their benefit in terms of a stream, the way the streams work, the way the tides work, the way the winds work, in order to be protected here. Up in 9, then, is where we see referenced the Feast of Atonement. Now, when much time had been spent and sailing was now dangerous because the fast was already over, Paul advised them. So we get this important note. Now, here's point of reference. We're 30 years into the New Testament church, which gives indication that they were still keeping this. It was still important to note this, especially as they were responsible for sailing in and around a time when they might be fasting. Now, I don't know how many of you have had opportunity to sail before. I can actually hold my hand up on this one. We spent, for those 6 years, we lived in San Diego, California. My dad, there was a man by the name of Doc Movius. He was an ear, nose, and throat man. And when we moved to San Diego, on occasion, Doc Movius would call my dad and say, "Do you want to go sailing?" Doc Movius was 70-plus at the time. Sailing vessel was probably 18 to 20 feet. And my dad would call me and say, "Do you want to go sailing?" And my first response is, "No, that seems uncool." And he would say, "No, you need to go sailing." And so we would go out here, and here's the reason why I would offer this. We would go out there on his vessel, and with San Diego Harbor, generally you might catch winds and you might catch chop, but it wasn't bad. But he would have us sail out the canal, and then we would oftentimes sail the shoreline there around San Diego. We did this about, probably 6 to 8 times. And despite the fact at first I always thought it was uncool, I was always amazed how much I enjoyed it. There was a part of me that even became a bit fascinated when we would come in contact with storms. Because if storm clouds came up, you would see Doc Movius really start shouting instructions at you. And even if I didn't know the language, he would say, no, you need to Philip, you need to do X or you need to do Y. So over this course of time, I had opportunity in a rather small way to get, I'm not going to say sea legs, but to get familiar with what we were dealing with. Now, the reason why I would offer this is because much of what's involved with sailing is unique to that environment. The language itself, his sense of wind. I loved doing this when we were out there. His sense of wind, which, the wind hitting you on which cheek of your face, he could tell you exactly where the wind was. He could tell you where the waves were. He could tell you at the times whenever you could see storm clouds, how we needed to, we didn't necessarily have a harbor, but how important it was to be shoreline and to sail shoreline based upon the way the water was running and the winds were running. And I was oftentimes fascinated by this. Here's why I offer this again, because that's a lot of what they were dealing with here. They were thinking through all these things as they were moving from Caesarea all the way to Malta. So that takes us through the first section there, verses 1 through 9. Let's go to section 2. This is only a few verses. I've entitled this, Paul warns of disaster, verses 9 through 12. Now, when much time had been spent and sailing was now dangerous, we hit that. Forgive me there. That should have fallen under the second section, but it still fits. Because the fast was over, Paul advised them. Here's Paul's advisement, verse 10, saying, "Men, I perceive that this voyage will end with disaster and much loss, not only of the cargo and ship, but also our lives. So I ask you, you ever had a premonition about something? You ever got into a situation and you thought to yourself, this doesn't seem like it's going to go well? What we don't have indication here, though we do have indication later by Luke, we don't have indication here that there was a special intervention that happened. An angel, as we'll see an angel here shortly. So what we can gather, based upon the language, is that for the most part, Paul was getting on this ship, and based upon all the factors, maybe the boat, maybe the captain, maybe the wheat, he didn't feel comfortable about this. And as we'll see here, he's going to talk about this a little bit later on. Now, you may have never, ever had a situation where you thought to yourself, how did I get in to this trouble spot? I offered one such scenario even when I was about 21, 22, I'd gone to Big Sandy, Texas to visit some friends. And in going down there, I had a buddy of mine who was an Ambassador College graduate that pulled up with a dirt bike and said, "Why don't you climb on the back and let's go riding?" And I said, "Where are we going riding?" And he said, "Just go with me. This is going to be fun." And why I said yes and got on the back, I still wonder why. My premonition was, this is not a good move. So if you are familiar at all with the Big Sandy area, old Highway 80 that happened to run from Big Sandy all the way to the Ambassador College campus there was all dirt road. It was as gravel as you get. And here the guy on the front of this motorcycle, well, dirt bike, was doing about 55, 60 passing people along the way. And I'm tapping him, holding on for dear life, saying, "Shouldn't we go a little bit slower?" No surprise here, I was praying along the way. He turned around. He's a little bit younger than I am, a couple years. And he said, "Wasn't that fun? Let's go right back and we'll go just as fast." And, you know, that's only about a 3 or 4 mile trip. And we got all the way back. We went back on that dirt bike just as fast. We're passing people along the way. And I said, "Should we be passing people? I'm really feeling uncomfortable about this." And we happened to, of all things, caught a stop sign. And in doing so, the stop sign, he said, "I hope we don't get pulled over. I don't have a license for this thing." And I thought, you have to be kidding. We for whatever reason, the bike, we went about another block, and the bike stalled. Now, my family doesn't even know this part. The bike stalled. And we couldn't get it jumped. We couldn't kickstart it again. And up rolls an officer. And he and I had just had a couple of beers. So you can probably guess what we smell like. And I thought to myself, how did I know this would end poorly? Long story short, the officer came up and said, "You guys, we had, you know, have some sense that you've been riding this bike around?" "Yes, sir, we have." All of a sudden, it's "Yes, sir." My "yes, sirs" came out in abundance. "Yes, sir, that was us." And I let him talk for a second. And then I backed up because I thought I was the one who drank the beer before I got on there. And I backed up just a hair and I let him talk. I'll leave this guy nameless. I let him talk for a few minutes. And for whatever reason, he eventually, we could get the engine running, but we couldn't keep it running. And so the officer said, "How far are you going?" And he said, "Well, we've got about 3 blocks." And the officer said, "Well, from everything you're telling me, I'm going to guess you're going to push that motorcycle the rest of the way." And he said, "Yes, sir, we are." And I said, "Yes, sir, we are." And so we wound up pushing the motorcycle back. So why tell you the story? Because my gut was, when I got on the back, this is not a good move. I'm headed a bad direction. The blessing is, isn't that funny? You think back. How many times could we have flipped on that dirt road, riding down there, passing cars on a gravel road on a motorcycle? I think sometimes God protects us and he's merciful. But in a case like this, that's kind of what I liken what I've read there in verse 10 to what Paul said. I perceive the voyage will end with disaster. Verse 11, "Nevertheless, the centurion was more persuaded by the helmsman and the owner of the ship than by the things spoken by Paul." Now, this is really telling us something, because the centurion is listening to Paul. Now, he eventually defers to the captain of the ship, but he listens to Paul. And so that's what we read in 11 and 12, reads this way, "And because the harbor was not suitable to winter in, the majority advised to set sail to reach Phoenix, a harbor of Crete opening toward the southwest and northwest, and winter there." So, remember we talked about this? We are over here by Fair Havens. They said, "You know what? We should go over here. That's where we should harbor. We should go and find that." In fact, Fair Havens, there's Fair Havens. Isn't that pretty? See, they could park a boat, they could park a ship in here and spend the winter and they'd be safe. And what you really see here is a protected area. But they were convinced that Phoenix would be the better option. And to do that, they would need to sail 40 more miles. So they head off from Fair Havens, headed for Phoenix, and our story will take a turn here next. We're up to section 3, the stormy sea, verse 13. And when the south wind blew softly, supposing that they had obtained their purpose, putting out to sea, they sailed by Crete. Verse 13 means they had a good wind. And when the south wind, 14, but not long after, a tempestuous headwind arose called Euroclydon. Now, this isn't necessarily a hurricane the way we name them today, the weather advisory or the weather station over here names them. This is the name of a hurricane-type force wind. And if you go by definition, it is generally a northeasterly wind from the Greek, but it also oftentimes means that it's a hurricane where you get blown in different directions, where you have winds that are coming from every different direction here. So in Europe, we see Euroclydon come up in 14, 15. So when the ship was caught and could not head into the wind, we let her drive. We just let it go. And running under the shelter of the island called Claudia, we secured the skiff with difficulty. We had to do all we could. Now, a skiff is a lifeboat. The lifeboat was at the front of it. This lifeboat or dinghy was the way that oftentimes the only way they could exit the ship. And obviously, it was big enough to take many, but could they take all 270 plus? No, it couldn't. But it was a means as a lifeboat. And so they chose to secure it there. The notion of securing the ship also involves the following. The term frapping in most commentaries comes up. And frapping just means cabling the hull, the ship together. Now, if you put your mind into this, the ships at that time were wood. And by wood, when they came into real stormy seas and inclement weather, they had to figure out ways how to keep everything together. So frapping was oftentimes one way to do this. And frapping came by putting cables. What they would do is run cables underneath the bow or the prow, underneath, and then they would bring them up and they would tie them almost like a big bow on top. Okay, and they would go to the stern and they would run a cable underneath or a thick rope underneath up, and then they would tie it. Now what's the aim here? They're trying to hold the hull together. That's what we're after, and we see that here. They did this oftentimes at the hull, but they also did it at the stern in order to keep everything afloat. Verse 18, and then because they were exceedingly tempest-tossed, the next day they lightened the ship. So they tied it all together and they said, it's still not enough. We got to start throwing stuff off because we're going to wind up drowning from all of this. They lightened the ship in 18. On the third day, we threw the ship's tackle overboard with our hands. Now when neither sun nor stars appeared for many days, and no small tempest beat on us, all hope that we would be saved was finally given up. Now it doesn't specify days here. We know that they could not see whether it was daytime or nighttime for many days. In fact, as we go further in here, we'll find out that the storm lasts, if you can believe this, 2 weeks they're in this. 2 weeks they're hanging on for dear life. So as we see here in that this tempest is rough, to say the least, they have done all they can just to stay alive. Now, we don't know if they're below surface or below deck, but we know that they're throwing stuff out just to stay alive. Verse 21, but after long abstinence from food, then Paul stood in the midst of them in the middle and said, men, you should have listened to me and not sailed. Remember what we talked about earlier, that premonition? He's saying it here. We shouldn't have sailed. Now, he's not doing a nah, 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 you were wrong. What he's saying is, you didn't listen to me before, now it's time to listen. And that's what we pick up at the tail end of 21, and incurred this disaster and loss. Now I urge you to take heart, for there will be no loss of life among you, but only of the ship. The ship will be wrecked, but you're going to stay alive. For there stood by me this night an angel of the God, to whom I belong and whom I serve, saying, do not be afraid, Paul. You must be brought before Caesar. And indeed, God has granted you all those who sail with you. Everyone who's with you will survive. And so indeed, as we see here, Paul says, you didn't listen before. Now it's time to listen. And you know what? They're listening now. And that's what we pick up from that language. I'm on 25, therefore take our men. Okay, 26. However, we must run aground on a certain island. But when the 14th night had come, remember we talked about 2 weeks of dealing with this? As they were driven up and down in the Adriatic Sea, about midnight, the sailors sensed that they were drawing near land. Now, they oftentimes did this by sounding, and we see that in 28. And they took soundings and found it to be 20 fathoms. If you go back and check the distance of a fathom is about 6 feet. So you do the math, 20 times 6, 120 feet. They got a sense here. They're doing soundings, pings, whatever they can in order to get some sense of where they are. They get 120 there. Verse 28 going on, and when they had gone a little further or farther, they took soundings again and found it to be 15 fathoms. You're doing the math? We're at 90 feet. So they know that they're getting closer to shore. Then fearing lest we should run aground on the rocks, they dropped 4 anchors from the stern, back of the boat. And interesting here, all of a sudden there's prayer. And prayed for day to come. All these, we didn't get any sense of prayer up till now. And all of a sudden, you got 200 plus men praying for their lives. Oh, please let us live. And so we see that in verse 29, 30. And as the sailors were seeking to escape from the ship, when they had let down the skiff into the sea, under pretense of putting out anchors from the prow. Now let's deal with 30 for a second. There was a group of sailors who were convinced that it made the most sense to go up front and to get rid of the lifeboat. They weren't getting rid of the lifeboat. What were they doing? They were climbing into the lifeboat and they were going to cut it loose. And so what Paul figures out is these guys are trying to jump and run. And if they jump and run, which is what we get in the next verse, we all die. Now I'm going to pause for a second. Because I think sometimes in life, I think there's a valuable lesson here, maybe for me, if not for you. How many times in life, when we deal with challenging situations, do we want to go run to the lifeboats and get out of there? When all we have to do is stay with God and stay on board. Because he'll see us through. There's a huge lesson in this for me, if not for you. And we see that in 30. Paul said to the centurion and the soldiers, unless these men stay in the ship, you cannot be saved. Then the soldiers in 32 cut away the ropes of the skiff and let it fall off. And as day was about to dawn, Paul implored them all to take food, saying, if you can believe this, today is the 14th day you have waited and continued without food. Wow! This is a wheat-faring vessel. And by Luke's record, and Luke being a physician, he's not leaving anything to accident. After 14 days, he says, we should eat. It's difficult for me to comprehend going 14 days without eating. But they went 14 days without eating. And he says, we really should eat. 34, therefore I urge you to take nourishment for this for your survival, since not a hair will fall from the head of any of you. And when he had taken these things, he took bread and gave thanks to God in the presence of them all. And when he had broken it, he began to eat. You'd almost think to yourself, after 14 days, that they're just going to start shoving bread. And he tells them this, and then he says, don't put it in your mouth yet. Let me ask a prayer. And they listen to him. 36, that they were all encouraged after eating and also took food themselves. And in all, we were 276 persons on the ship. So when they had eaten enough, they lightened the ship and threw out the wheat into the sea. So all that wheat, likely in bags, they were pitching over the sides. We got to get rid of it because otherwise we're not going to survive. We're up to the last section, shipwrecked at Malta, and that's what we'll tackle, verses 39 through 44. Now, when it was day, they did not recognize the land, but they observed a bay with a beach onto which they planned to run the ship if possible. They wanted to crash it in there. And they let go the anchors and left them in the sea. Meanwhile, loosing the rudder ropes, they hoisted the mainsail to the wind and made for shore. There, most of those ships generally had two rudders. In fact, interestingly enough, I didn't know this. They oftentimes, which makes sense based even on how the hull would have worked, they had a rudder in the front and a rudder in the back so that they could steer depending on whatever direction they wanted to go. And so that's what we see reflected here. 41, but striking a place where the two seas met. So I'm going to punch the map. We've gotten a sense that the Adriatic Sea, which we see referenced here, is here. And then we see this other sea here. And what he is referring to is the connector between these two seas, where they run into each other. That's exactly where he's referencing, which would take us to Malta, and he's going to mention that here. But striking verse 41, a place where the two seas met, they ran the ship aground, and the prow, or the bow, stuck fast and remained immovable. But the stern was being broken up by the violence of the waves. Now the soldiers' plan was to kill the prisoners. Why would they have to kill them? Because if you lose a prisoner, you lose your life. So they were going to take all the lives because they couldn't afford to lose all these men. Except the centurion has respect for Paul. Lest any of them should swim away and escape. The latter into 42. 43. But the centurion, wanting to save Paul, kept them from their purpose and commanded that those who could swim should jump overboard first and get to land, swim to land. And the rest, some on boards, you're going to pull a board off and you're going to hold on, and some on broken pieces of the ship. And so it was that they all escaped safely to land. You know, at the beginning of this message, I asked you five questions. I asked about who the author of Acts 27 was. I asked you who his travel companions were. I asked you which feast and holy day was mentioned. I asked you what the angel told him, Paul. And I asked you how many died in the shipwreck. Now, you can answer all those questions now pretty quickly, I would trust. As I read this story, I found myself kind of thinking at length about why does God give us these stories? Now, I like these stories. I'm into these stories. In fact, my wife said earlier this morning, boy, you are animated with that story. And I said, those stories are great to me. And I got to thinking about why is this story important? Why would God give us stories like this? And I'm going to give you what I believe to be just three brief reasons. First of all, Paul's account reminds us how God cares for his people. Luke 12. We're going to go to just two verses in Luke 12. Remember how, as we see happen here, Paul has the motivation, the inspiration to say that everyone would be saved, even the hair on their head. Luke 12. Luke 12, verses 6 and 7. Sometimes I have a hard time comprehending this, but this gives us some sense of how God sees us all personally, gives attention to us all personally, not just in a minimal way, but in a very all-encompassing, significant way. Luke 12, verses 6 and 7. Are not five sparrows, nowhere reminded of this section of Scripture, are not five sparrows sold for two copper coins, and not one of them is forgotten before God? Just a sparrow. You know, I think about all the sparrows in our neighborhood, and in one of those times, sometimes I feel like, man, I'd love to have a BB gun, because just sparrows are going nuts here. But sparrows, God sees all of them. Every time they fall, God sees it. Verse 7, but the very hairs of your head. Now, for some of us, for me, it's getting fewer all the time. But the very hairs of your head are numbered. You don't think God pays attention to you? We spend so much of our time trying to create God in our thinking, the way we see the world, that we miss at times recognizing how God really sees the world. God sees everything. He sees you and me every minute of every day, right down to every hair on your head. He knows. The latter end of verse 7, do not fear, therefore, you are of more value than many sparrows. Why would God tell a story like this? To show how much he cares for his people. He sees it all. He knows it all. Second lesson, at least comes to mind as I covered Acts 27, is that this account is written for our encouragement. Now, you're probably going to say to yourself, or maybe to your neighbor, is he serious? This was one of the worst storms we could imagine. They went 14 days without knowing whether it was day or night. They were barely holding it together. How in the world could this be of encouragement? James 1. James 1 is a section of scripture obviously authored by James. And the verses that happen at the beginning of James provide a segue, an introduction into going on to perfection. But it starts this way. James 1, verse 1 reads, "A servant of God and of the Lord Jesus Christ." Verse 2, "My brethren, count it all joy." Count it all joy when you fall into various trials. How often do you think that? How often, as you're going through a trial, not knowing where the answer will be, not knowing how you got into the trial, how often do you and I think to ourselves, this is a time of joy? Generally, we don't. But James reminds us that we should. And as we go on from 4, it reads this way, knowing that, here's why, the testing of your faith produces patience. And then we get all of this beautiful language that goes on from there. Let patience have its perfect work, that you may be perfect and complete, and all of these things that go down. So here's why I offer this. We're able to read this account because we see Paul's faith in action. And we're reminded that as we go through trials, whatever that trial is, that God's just refining you and me. He's sending us back to our knees. He's having us look in His Word for answers. He's having us beseech Him and ask that He stir up that Spirit in us so that we are refined, made pure so that He can work with us in greater ways in the future. You know, I had a student the other day who gave a leadership speech, and she made an interesting point. She made the following statement. She said that any leader, and she was referencing those who happen to be at work or in a family or in her church, she said, generally people don't aspire or grow greater than the person who's in charge. And I thought to myself, here's where I personalize stuff. I thought to myself, am I limiting the growth of everyone in both congregations by me not growing fast enough? And maybe I can pose the same question to you. Are you limiting the growth of people around you because you're not growing enough? Trials allow that growth. Trials are opportunities to be encouraged. So we see here, even through this, as we read it, that indeed Paul's difficulty through that shipwreck, still a point of encouragement. Here's the last thing I had, and happened to, even as I wrote this note, I didn't know directly where I was going, but it occurred to me that sometimes in class, in training and development that I teach, we oftentimes talk about learning styles. We go through Alan Mumford's learning theory. And learning theory is that if you take in information from a variety of sources, whether it be visual or whether it be oral or whether it be kinesthetic, you know, get your hands on it, that one way or another, we're going to get the message through. And what research has shown us even more lately is that whenever we do this, it's actually getting messages from different perspectives, different forms of media, that actually gets through. Now, it's not always clear why one type of media or one type of message gets through to us. But we know from repeated being sensitized, getting the same message multiple ways, that eventually it gets through. That's how people learn. So here's why I would go with this. Because the beauty of God's Word is that God tells the exact same lessons about 100 different ways. From Genesis to Revelation, his plan is laid out, his law is laid out, his truths are laid out. But he tells us how about 5, 6, 7 different ways. Now here's the strange part, and it probably doesn't apply to you, it applies to me. Have you ever gone to Scripture and you've read the exact same section of Scripture 20 or 30 times? And the 21st time, you read something you've never seen before. That's how God's Word works. That's how God works with us. He tells us and offers us codified law up front. He offers prophecies. He offers writings. He offers New Testament stories and truths. And he does it so that it's repeatedly going into us and the message is getting in. His desire is that it all gets in here and here so that we're more like him. You know, I had a conversation with someone on the phone the other day, and the individual said to me, I'm having difficulty getting to God. I'm not sure he's talking and dealing with me. And the comment I made to this person is, are you reading your Bible? Because he's talking to you there all the time. There was this long pause. 2 Timothy 3:16 says what? All Scripture is God-breathed. Whether it come in the form of Numbers or in the form of Isaiah or in the form of a New Testament account, it's all God-breathed. It's all there. It's all there for our teaching, edification, all the rest of those items that appear there in 2 Timothy 3:16. And it's in John 17:17 that God says, that Christ is inspired to say, sanctify them, set them apart through your truth. Your word is truth. God offers multiple different ways to get his lessons through. As long as we keep our nose in that book, we'll be safe and learn those lessons. And that's what we read in Acts 27. So looking forward to Acts 28. We have one chapter to go. We will read some amazing accounts. It's not shipwreck season on Acts 28. But in a case like this, we'll see that even in Malta, as he spends his time, Paul spends his time, he hangs out by the fire. He's bit by a poisonous snake that he shakes off, and everyone thinks he's a god because of this. You should go read that part. It's quite interesting. He does some tremendous miracles in terms of healing, and ultimately, he's able to fulfill the commission, the responsibility given for him when he goes to Rome, and that's to preach. He goes to the Jews, and he goes to the Gentiles, and he's able to preach at Rome. I encourage you to read ahead.